What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Menachem Kaiser, author of the new book, Plunder, A Memoir of Family Property and Nazi Treasure. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's Super Bowl Sunday today, a contemporary American holiday that's surpassed most of the others on our calendar in observance. Certainly in a normal year, more people celebrate Super Bowl Sunday by having a party to watch the game, drink beer and other things, and overeat, than actively participate in, oh, President's Day or Labor Day or Martin Luther King Day or Memorial Day. Super Bowl Sunday is in all likelihood the third most observed American festival day, after Thanksgiving and the 4th of July, and slightly ahead of both Christmas and Valentine's Day, which have limitations on their popularity. I mean, there are lots of Christians in the U.S., but the current figure is just 65% of the population, so not everybody celebrates it, including, of course, not us Jews. And Valentine's Day really doesn't work if you don't have a date or you're too young or too wise or really just don't care about a holiday invented by greeting card and candy companies, the Amalgamated Union of Florists, jewelry cartels, and the restaurateurs of America. So Super Bowl Sunday is a big holiday in its own highly commercialized way. Even if this year, when Super Bowl parties are limited to those folks who live in your bubble with you, they will be smaller than usual. There have been significant Jewish angles to the last few Super Bowls, and there's one this year, too. 3 years ago, both owners, Jeffrey Lurie of the Eagles and Robert Kraft of the Patriots, were Jewish, as was Eagles general manager Howie Roseman. Actually, 9 out of 32 NFL owners today are Jewish, as is the Glazer family, owners of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who are playing today. Should the Bucs prevail, it would be the second Super Bowl championship for the Glazer family. Tampa won the franchise's only NFL crown back in 2003. Malcolm Glazer, a Jewish billionaire, bought the team in 1995 for $192 million, at the time a league record. His children own it now, and it was a good investment. It's currently worth about $2 billion. 2 years ago, when Kraft's Patriots beat the Rams, Julian Edelman, the Patriots' wideout, became the first Jewish Super Bowl MVP. There was another Jewish player on the Patriot, Nate Ebner, saw action in that game. The stadiums for the past three Super Bowls have been owned or operated by Jews. Ziggy Wilf in Minnesota, Arthur Blank in Atlanta, and this year the Glazers in Tampa. And then last year, Mitchell Schwartz, all-pro right tackle for the Chiefs, became a Super Bowl champion protecting quarterback Pat Mahomes. So, who's the Jewish connection this year, you may ask? Well, the Chiefs are back, but sadly, Mitchell Schwartz is hurt and won't play today. The Chiefs' star lineman was bar mitzvahed at Temple Adat Shalom in West Los Angeles and wasn't permitted by his parents to play organized football until he completed his bar mitzvah studies, by the way. He and his older brother, Jeff Schwartz, were the first Jewish brothers to play on the same NFL field, on opposing teams, by the way, in over 80 years. They wrote a light, funny book 3 years ago, well, maybe it's 4 or 5 years ago now, called Eat My Schwartz, our story of NFL football, food, family, and faith. Anyway, they were the first Jewish brothers to play pro football since Ralph and Arnold Horween, those immortals, in 1923. Anyway, the Jewish connection this year is Ali Marpet, who's 27 years old and plays left guard for the Tampa Bay Bucks and has been especially strong protecting Tom Brady. He has not allowed a single sack of the iconic quarterback all season. Marpet's the son of a musician and a fashion photographer from New York's suburban Westchester County who used to host Shabbat gatherings for family and friends. Marpet's story is interesting. He attended Hobart College, arriving unheralded at the school of 2,400 students in upstate New York. At the Division III level, where colleges do not give athletic scholarships and players basically never reach the pros, Marpet grew to be over 300 pounds, combining athletic prowess and a strong work ethic, and made himself a bona fide NFL prospect. The Bucks picked him in the second round of the 2015 NFL draft. Marpet is a Birthright Israel alum. He's enjoyed a standout career. Has a five-year, $54 million contract he signed a few years ago. There were a lot of things along the way that had to line up almost perfectly for me to end up where I am, Ali Marpet said last week. There wasn't one moment that made the difference. It was a collection of moments. Me going to Hobart instead of trying to walk on at a D1 AA school or maybe going to another D3 school that didn't take football seriously. There were so many ways this could have played out. Marpet is now playing in the biggest game of all, with hopes of becoming another Jewish Super Bowl champion like Schwartz. Which means you should serve something kosher, say Hebrew National hot dogs, along with your other treats this Super Bowl, in honor of this Jewish connection to a very American festival. To play us in this morning, here's an unusual offering, Indian-Israeli singer Liora Yitzchak, whose parents are Bene Yisrael of Gujarati origins, singing Ofra Chaza's classic song Shnei Shoshanim, Two Roses, highlighting two very different Jewish musical styles. Liora Yitzchak singing with Marsh Dondorma, Shnei Shoshanim. When we come back on Two Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Menachem Kaiser, will explain how he got involved trying to recover his family's property in Poland, where it most unexpectedly led him. It's a great story. Find it out when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has now created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone during normal times. During these days of coronavirus tsaros, a small group joins us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Be part of that by emailing me to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services with our musicians at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m. all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, and we'll hold services with full music, live and by virtual experience weekly. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, and many are also in blended format. Access them by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or emailing me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school and many of the Adult Education Academy classes are available in blended formats, some live and some people on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and, of course, all of our services, live or on Facebook Live, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Menachem Kaiser has written really a fascinating book called Plunder, a memoir of family property and Nazi treasure, which is out just about now. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So, is this a strict memoir? Is there any creativity, fictional aspect to it at all?
Interesting question. No, it's all true. It's definitely all true. Yeah, nothing's made up. So, true story.
I ask that because there'd been really a lot of books about the Holocaust and recovering Holocaust experience in which people are not such careful documenters of what went on. You really are. You were reluctant to take up this quest. Tell us a little bit about the origins of Plunder.
Sure. So I started going to Poland in about 2015. And so my grandparents on my father's side, they're Polish Holocaust survivors. But I never really grew up with what I would call like a Holocaust narrative. My grandfather died well before I was born. And it just wasn't like we obviously were aware, and it was something embedded, I'd say, in our childhood. But it's, you know, I never knew the story. I didn't really receive any kind of trauma. Like, no one would really have cared if I never went to Poland. It just wasn't something that was prioritized in the family. So I went to Poland in 2015, really kind of on a lark, and ended up meeting some interesting people in Lithuania. They invited me to come to Krakow for Rosh Hashanah. And then once I was there, I felt, you know, let's just kind of go check out where my grandfather was from. Really, it was a one-time thing, a kind of a pilgrimage. And then I went, I took photos. I had a nice time. It was fine. And then I was like, I'll probably never go back. But I ended up spending quite a bit of time in Poland working on projects totally unrelated to my family. And then over the years, my father kept mentioning, he's like, you know, this building, you know, we own it and we have all these documents. You should check it out. And for years, I just didn't do anything about it. It just really wasn't a priority. But then I just kind of met more and more people and like developed a community and, you know, met people who had also recovered property. And I thought, what the heck? It seems like an interesting thing. So I saw the documents, and once I saw the documents, I found them kind of moving. I never knew my grandfather, and I never really knew much about him. I am named after him, but I did see for the first time, I saw like a struggle, I'd say. They come through in the documents that he really tried for 20 years and was really frustrated through different bureaucracies and sort of different plans, contacting different people and always getting stymied. And so I thought, again, I was like kind of on a lark. I went ahead and I contacted a lawyer. And then once I did that, I really fell down a rabbit hole. But even at that point, I'd say I was very reluctant to write about it. I just didn't feel like I found my story to be an interesting and meaningful one, but I didn't know if it was something so new. And I was kind of scared to enter the genre. I think there's a lot of pitfalls in trying to write a Holocaust, a quote unquote Holocaust memoir. And then later I fell down a much deeper rabbit hole when I found out that my grandfather actually had a relative who survived the war that we never knew about, and named Abraham Kaiser. And this Abraham, because of the diary he had written during the war, is a major, major celebrity among treasure hunters. And so once that happened, I sort of said, I think there might be a book here.
It's a fascinating story. We will talk much more with Menachem Kaiser about his book, Plunder, and I will probably fall down that rabbit hole too when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week, we were talking about the number of Jewish cabinet-level officers in the Biden administration and other senior-level officials, and mentioned the fact that sometimes these are Orthodox Jews serving in these positions. You've had some experience with that, particularly in the Foreign Service. Must be more challenging, I would think.
Right. Certainly overseas when you work in an embassy. And let's talk about the Foreign Service for a minute in this particular light, because in the old days, they only gave the entrance exam on Saturday. So if you were a Sabbath observant Jew, in other words, if you were Orthodox, you couldn't apply de facto to the Foreign Service. Then somebody took this like way up the court system and sued the State Department. So then they instituted an option for both Jews and Seventh-day Adventists to take the exam on Sunday. So Orthodox Jews could enter the Foreign Service. And some of those Orthodox Jews who entered the Foreign Service and followed the Foreign Service career path eventually became ambassadors. And other Orthodox Jews who became ambassadors were political appointees. So they didn't do a whole career in the Foreign Service, but they knew in advance that the government would have to make special accommodations. So part of that is extra sets of dishes and glassware, which are provided by the U.S. government to an ambassador for official entertaining, but de facto for all use. And, you know, a kosher observant Jew needs two sets of dishes for every day,
right.
dairy and meat, right? Two sets for Passover, dairy and meat, and two sets for very special occasions like state dinners or something when you don't want to put the everyday stuff out. So it's a big investment to provide
a lot of crockery,
an Orthodox ambassador with everything that he or she needs. But there are other questions as well. Like, an ambassador's job is really 24/7. You can get at any moment a telegram from the State Department with the caption that means you have to take action even if it's the middle of the night. If you get this at 2 a.m., you can't wait till 8 a.m. to deal with it. You have to deal with it now. That's used very sparingly. But some of those telegrams and some of those instructions can only be read by the ambassador. So I think the way most observant Jews who become ambassadors work this out is a big chunk of their job is about preventing war or mass murders or genocides.
Or terrorism or something terrible.
Well, things that would evolve into causing deaths.
Right, okay.
Of whatever. What, by whatever
However
means.
It happens.
I mean, even right. like public health issues.
Sure.
Okay, so
coronavirus, whatever, something.
So you know as well as I that there's an important principle in Jewish law, Pokeach Nefesh Dochet Kulam.
Dochet HaShabbat, actually, Dochet HaKulam, right.
Which means saving a life is more important than all the other mitzvahs put together. So you're allowed to violate the laws of Sabbath or whatever. And if you need to go into the embassy in order to prevent a war, you know, you're not only saving a life, you're saving hundreds of thousands of lives. And that's a pretty good reason to override the normal restrictions that apply during the Jewish Sabbath. And I think that's how most Orthodox ambassadors interpret the potential conflict between observing Jewish law and doing what you need to do.
Fulfilling their duty as an ambassador.
As a professional,
as
right.
As a professional, right. Interesting contrast, you know, an important challenge, right, obviously, but one that Orthodox Jews have figured out a way to fulfill. I'm still fascinated by how they requisition the meat and dairy plates from the U.S. government and how they make sure that they look different enough to do it.
No, they look exactly the same. That's part of the trick.
Part of the problem, yeah.
That all government issued, well, for State Department senior officials, the crockery all looks exactly the same. There's not a different design for dairy and meat.
You have to come up with something. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. An old man is sitting on the curb, sobbing and crying loudly. Oy vey, oy gibbo. A passerby stops and asks him, "Old man, why are you crying? Are things so bad?" "No, not at all," the old man sobs, wiping his tears. "I'm 95 years old. Last week I married a beautiful 28-year-old woman. She treats me wonderfully. She's a fabulous cook, generous, sweet. And in the bedroom, it's amazing. Everything's fantastic." And then he sobs loudly and starts crying again. "Why are you crying?" asked the passersby. "Because I can't remember where I live." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and try to remember where you live. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as any in the whole Torah. After the last few weeks of dramatic Torah portions featuring some of the greatest highlights in the whole of Jewish tradition, indeed all religious history, Mishpatim might seem a major letdown. Last week, amid the smoke and thunder at Mount Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea for us. We miraculously crossed on dry land. And in the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians, and Pharaoh and Moses had a duel of wills in the desert. But Mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws about how to interact with other human beings. Civil legislation. How exciting. How to handle somebody else's property fairly. How to assess punitive damages for a man who injures another person or destroys somebody else's property. How to act when someone puts his or her property in trust with you. The laws of manslaughter, theft, damages. Boring laws, many of them tediously detailed. And nobody really likes reading law books. If the Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, this is an array of detailed legislation about human interaction that seems so trivial as not to belong in a sacred book at all. So why is Mishpatim here? Human beings have no love of law, or usually of lawyers, but without laws and without enforcement, we fallible creatures wouldn't function well at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would tear each other apart. Where anarchy reigns, justice does not. And that's where Mishpatim comes in. For we need law, and we need limits, although we might not like either one much. Judaism understands that if we are truly to be good, or truly free, we must observe the laws and rules of human decency, embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Because before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. Before we can make this world holy, we must treat each other with civility. It is a great fundamental lesson we seem to need to relearn in every generation. A final note. At the end of this week's Parsha, after all the rules and laws, the torts and talionises, God reveals a glimpse of the divine essence to Moses. Why here? Well, because Mishpatim teaches that we can only experience real holiness when we start by respecting our fellow men and women. When we come to understand that we are all in this together, that the way to God is actually through the ways we learn to work together, to trust one another. And we must do this in simple, practical, daily ways, following the decent rules for human interaction. Freedom and holiness are dependent on the little laws established in Mishpatim, on the civility that rules require. May we all remember that this week and every week. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Menachem Kaiser, will tell us about the struggle to recover his family's property in Poland and how it led to a secret series of Nazi tunnels and, well, it's quite fascinating. Find out all about it when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
More than 170 black and Jewish entertainers, including Billy Porter, Sharon Osbourne, Mayim Bialik, and Tiffany Haddish, joined forces to combat racism and anti-Semitism last week. The new organization, Black Jewish Entertainment Alliance, launched on the first day of Black History Month as institutional racism and anti-Semitism remain rampant in the United States. They will be running full-page ads in industry publications, Variety, and Billboard this week. The Jewish community must continue to speak out against racial injustice and work to effect change, while the black community must continue to speak out against all forms of anti-Semitism, the Unity Statement reads. In the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr., Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, and the many blacks and Jews who stood together in the fight for civil rights, we come together to support each other in the struggle against hatred and bigotry. Mayim Bialik, a past guest of Too Jewish, said, The black and Jewish communities have long been aligned and fought side by side for justice. I was raised with my parents' stories of protests and civil disobedience in the civil rights movement. They saw it as a Jewish imperative to remember our legacy of once being slaves in Egypt. It is our duty to embrace those who have struggled and continue to fight for justice. It's interesting being a part of both groups, said singer-songwriter Autumn Rowe, one of the signatories. Her father is black and her mother is Jewish. Sometimes when you're going through something yourself, it's hard to see what other people are going through. America is still grappling with the aftermath of the death of George Floyd last year, a black man who died after a white police officer knelt on his neck for 9 minutes. His death prompted those sweeping renewed calls and protests for racial justice. At the same time, anti-Semitic attacks persist, and recent surveys indicate that most millennials and Gen Zers lack any Holocaust education. The new organization will put on events showcasing the black and Jewish communities' fight against hate. The Alliance will elevate voices in the entertainment community that can help the public better understand the causes, manifestations, and effects of racism and anti-Semitism, ensuring our industry is doing its part to be a voice for hope, unity, and healing in our country, said Aaron Bayshuk, co-chairman and CEO of Warner Records. In Poland, two Polish historians face a libel trial for a scholarly examination of Polish behavior during World War II, a case whose outcome is expected to determine the fate of independent Holocaust research under Poland's nationalist government. A verdict is expected in Warsaw's District Court February 9th in the case against Jan Grabowski and Barbara Enkelging, historians with the Polish Center for Holocaust Research in Warsaw. This is the first major legal test in the wake of a 2018 law that makes it a crime to falsely accuse the Polish nation of crimes committed by Nazi Germany. That law caused a major diplomatic spat with Israel. Since it won power back in 2015, the conservative ruling party in Poland, Law and Justice, has sought to discourage investigations into Polish wrongdoing during the wartime German occupation, preferring to almost exclusively stress Polish heroism and suffering. The aim is to promote national pride, but critics say the government has been whitewashing the fact that some Poles collaborated in the German massacre, murder, slaughter of Jews. The Israeli Holocaust Museum Yad Vashem said the legal effort constitutes a serious attack on free and open research. A number of other historical institutions have condemned the case as the verdict nears, with a Paris-based foundation for the memory of the Shoah describing it as a witch hunt and a pernicious invasion into the very heart of research. The case centers on a 1,600-page, two-volume historical work in Polish, Night Without End, The Fate of Jews in Selected Counties of Occupied Poland, co-edited by Grabowski and Engelking. An abridged English version is due to be published in a couple of months. Grabowski and Engelking say they see the case as an attempt to discredit them personally and discourage other researchers from investigating the truth about the extermination of Jews in Poland. This is a case of the Polish state against freedom of research, Grabowski says. Grabowski, a Polish-Canadian who is also a professor at the University of Ottawa and whose father was a Polish Holocaust survivor, has faced considerable anti-Semitic harassment by Polish nationalists, both online and at lectures in Canada, France, and elsewhere. The niece of a man in the village of Malinowo, whose wartime behavior is briefly mentioned in the book, is suing Grabowski and Engelking, demanding 100,000 zlotys, $27,000 or so, in damages and an apology in newspapers. According to evidence presented carefully in the book, Edward Malinowski, an elder in the village, allowed a Jewish woman to survive by helping her pass as a non-Jew. But that survivor is also quoted as saying that he was an accomplice in the deaths of dozens of other Jews. The man's niece has been backed by a group, the Polish League Against Defamation, which receives funding from the Polish government. That organization argued that the two scholars are guilty of defiling the good name of a Polish hero, whom they claim had no role harming Jews. The lawsuit was filed in court free of charge, as allowed under the 2018 law. Mark Weitzman, director of government affairs for the Simon Wiesenthal Center, called Night Without End a meticulously researched and sourced book that details thousands of cases of complicity by Poles in the murder of Jews during the Holocaust. The proceedings against these two scholars of international repute are nothing more than an attempt to use the legal system to muzzle and intimidate scholarship on the Holocaust in Poland, said Weizmann. Grabowski said, Night Without End is multifaceted. It talks about Polish virtue just as much as the other stuff. It paints a truthful picture. The Holocaust is not here to help the Polish ego and morale. It's a drama involving the death of 6 million people, which seems to be forgotten by the nationalists, he said. The involvement in this trial of an organization heavily subsidized with Polish government funds is a form of censorship, an attempt to frighten scholars away from publishing the results of their research out of fear of a lawsuit and the ensuing costly litigation, said Zygmunt Stepinski, director of the Polin Museum of the History of Polish Jews in Warsaw. Finally, the U.S. Supreme Court delivered a setback to a bid by the heirs of Jewish art dealers seeking to win restitution from Germany and American courts for a coerced sale forced by the former Nazi government in 1935 of a collection of precious medieval religious art. The justices, in a unanimous 9-0 ruling, decided that the lawsuit cannot proceed under a U.S. law called the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that limits the jurisdiction of American courts in claims against foreign governments. They threw out a lower court's decision that the lawsuit could move forward in federal court in Washington. While the justices decided this law barred the claims that the heirs brought against a German agency that administers state museums, they did direct lower courts to re-examine other arguments made in the case, meaning the lawsuit potentially could still proceed. And in addition, the justices threw out a lower court ruling that it allowed a similar lawsuit to proceed against Hungary, seeking restitution for Jewish people whose property was forcibly taken as part of that nation's collaboration with its Nazi allies during World War II. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guests this morning, Menachem Kaiser, whose memoir, Plunder, is about, kind of treasure hunting, but more than that, following, as we said earlier in the show, this building that his family had owned and had trying to recover the Holocaust legacy, and then meeting an aspect of the family that had survived that he never knew existed. Great character, your lawyer, the killer. Tell us a little bit about her.
Sure. So when I decided I would try to reclaim the building, or at least look into it, I contacted like a local macher, I'd say, like a Brooklyn-born chassid who's been living in Krakow for years and years and been trying to crack the real estate game. And so he referred me to this lawyer who some of the people in the community have used as a real estate lawyer. She goes by the killer. And the killer is she's in her 80s, very stoic, very severe, very bright, but like very, let's say, old fashioned. You know, they really like work the sign kind of the same way they did 30 years ago. And we just like made a team. So it was like the killer and her daughter, who's her interpreter and her kind of paralegal. And so, yeah, it's been almost 6 years that we've been working together on this.
I can't imagine trying to get something out of the Polish government in this way.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting, that's one of the things I really struggle with, like in the book, of like how generous to be towards the Polish government. And so I really go back and forth in terms of like, is it just a bureaucracy that, you know, how sympathetic and understanding should I be towards the bureaucracy? And so it was really kind of a roller coaster in that regard. But the main impediment I had was getting the death certificates for my relatives who died in the Holocaust, which was like a really surreal thing because I was petitioning the court to recognize these deaths of, you know, of my great grandfather who was, you know, born in the 1880s. And so that one was like very, you know, it was both, we made mistakes. There was like a distinct lack of generosity, you know, to be diplomatic on the part of the Polish courts. But yeah, it is a weird Kafka-esque kind of ordeal.
Tell us about discovering that some of the family had survived.
So what happened also in like 2015, completely unrelated to what I was doing with family property, these reports started coming out about these Polish treasure hunters that they had discovered what was called the Golden Train. And the Golden Train is this ostensibly legendary train full of looted Nazi gold buried in a mountain. And so it became very big news because two of these, what the media called treasure hunters, sort of announced that they had found the train, and the international media kind of made a sensation about it. So I was seeing it all over the place, New York Times, The New Yorker, BBC, Time Magazine, Fox, like everyone descended onto this tiny village. And so I was kind of tickled by it. And I was just hanging out in Poland anyway. So I said, I just kind of want to see what was going on. And at the time I was writing a novel. I said, you know what, maybe this would be interesting for the novel. So I hired a guide, a woman named Joanna Lamparska. And she introduced me to some of the treasure hunters, and they took me to some of these underground complexes that were secret Nazi complexes built by Jewish slave labor during the war. And it really just kind of broke my brain. These kinds of things are just really extraordinary. But there is no primary documentation for these tunnels. And these things are called Project Riese, which is a German word for giant. And so when we were just sort of sitting and having a beer with some of the treasure hunters. And one of my friends who I brought with, she asked them a difficult question. You know, it was all really fun and games, and we were just sort of enjoying the absurdity. But she said, like, what do you guys do about the fact that, like, 10, I can't remember them, I think it's 14,000 Jews died digging these tunnels. Like, how does that figure into your narrative? And so they got really animated, and they started talking in Polish very quickly, and I don't speak Polish. But inside the Polish, I was able to hear my last name. They kept saying Kaiser repeatedly, but just over and over again. And so, like, I ended up stopping them and say, who are you talking about? And they're like, Abraham Kaiser, the great. And they started just heaping praise on this man named Abraham Kaiser. And so it turned out that Abraham had written a secret diary while a slave laborer. Then he survived, and after the war, he went from camp to camp, and he collected his notes, and it got published in Poland in the 60s. And then this diary, because there is no primary documentation for these tunnels, the diary has become a kind of like an urtext, a kind of essential reading. And so all these treasure hunters, they really, I would say they mythologize the diary and Abraham Kaiser. And then I had developed these family trees because of the family property. And I was able to determine that he was my grandfather's first cousin, i.e. the closest surviving relative. Like, we had no idea that anyone had survived the war. And once the treasure hunters found out that I was related, they quickly embraced me, and I became kind of a celebrity.
And an honorary treasure hunter?
Oh, yeah. No, they call it explorations. And so I've done quite a few of these explorations. Yeah,
I don't know how to describe this, but what a strange thing to be doing.
It is very weird. It's treasure hunting is like a weird term. And so people, you know, they conjure up anything from Indiana Jones to sort of like guys on the beach with metal detectors. And it's kind of includes all that. So it is a very big community. And on one side of the spectrum, you have fairly sophisticated exploration groups. And so they could have very fancy equipment, like LIDAR, georadar, like magnetic imaging and all these things. And there could be a lot of money involved. But the bulk of it is sort of like hobbyists, just sort of guys who do this on the weekend, and sometimes very seriously, and they go out with radar detectors and they'll explore these tunnels, and they're really just having a kind of a good time. But it's all sort of lumped in under this category of treasure hunters.
And Silesia, where this was done, is Poland today, but it kind of has a German identity too, you talk about. It's so strange, I think, to be Jewish in that setting.
Yeah, it's an interesting land. It's like a what I, you know, I say it's haunted. It was German. It was Germany for, it's like the Poland narrative considers it Polish with a break. Like if you go way back, sort of before the 15th century, it was, part of like the early Piast dynasty. But it's most of the modern era, it was, what we would call Germany or Prussian Empire. And then it, after the war, they pushed the Polish border west. And so it became, the big chunk of it became Poland, a little bit of Silesia is in Germany and a tiny little bit in the Czech Republic. And they pushed the eastern border, what is now Ukraine, they pushed that west as well. And so you just have like extraordinary displacement in Silesia. You just have like a lot of the, it's not really like the rest of Poland in the sense of like the architecture is very German. The towns have a very Germanic feel, even though they've, like after the war, they sort of weird to this strange Polonization campaign.
I just want to say, in Poland, Jews are mostly absent. I mean, there were millions of Jews in Poland before the war. Warsaw may have been 30% Jewish. And it seems to me there's two reactions. There's Poles there, younger Poles especially, who feel like something's missing in Polish culture because the Jews are missing. And then there's undoubtedly some of the antique anti-Semitism, which is maybe in the soil of Europe and particularly Poland. What was your experience obviously you had a great deal of resistance as you looked at reclaiming this building. What was your experience of Poles and their attitude towards Jews while you were there? You've been there a number of times.
Yeah, so I went to Poland for like once or twice a year for about a decade. And so, most of these trips were spent a considerable amount of time and made a lot of very close friends. I will say my experience has been overwhelmingly positive. And so I would sort of divide my experience into two categories, and pretty much aligns with an urban rural. And so like when I spend times with my friends in, let's say, Warsaw or Krakow or Wrocław, and like the people I tend to meet skew a lot younger, very educated, well-traveled. There, like, my experience has been just incredible. There's a sort of deep respect, deep curiosity. Poland, my Eastern Europe adventures really started in Lithuania. And so, like, when I went from Lithuania to Poland, I was sort of amazed by, like, how much institutional support there is. Just how much of an embrace, how many, like, Polish artists are working on, and Polish artists and Polish intellectuals are involved, like, in these sort of interesting memory questions. Now, like, the political situation is not great, and so, like, the Polish government, for especially the last 3 years, has turned very right-wing, and they have a very complicated, very negative, it's a deeply nationalist government, and so, sometimes they embrace what you call Jewish narratives for their own ends, but there's definitely sort of an erasure of history happening. Now, in the rural areas, and, it's a little different. I didn't really experience what I would call out and out anti-Semitism. I would call it like sort of what you baked in, like very, it's just in there, and sort of either it's like strange stereotypes or, like they look, maybe they're suspicious and it's a little bit different, but I will say even with the treasure hunters who are, they speak their mind. Let's put it like that. Just like a really warm embrace. Like stuff that, I might not repeat at the dinner table, but I didn't find, with the maybe exception of the court, and even then I don't know. Like you just don't, when you get like a court decision that are frustrating, you just don't know what's going on. And like even while I was doing this, there was like a whole, there was basically the government assault, the independence of the judiciary. And so I have no idea. You don't know what's going on in a judge's mind.
Tell us, I don't want to give away too much, but how do you feel about how the whole narrative ends?
Originally, when I set out and I started writing this book, I really imagined a kind of triumphant, I imagine one of two endings. I imagine I would get the building back. And to me, that was like a triumphant ending. And like I finished the mission. Or I imagine just like a failure, which, you know, is bad. I didn't get the building back, but it's sort of pretty good ending to a book. Now, neither happened. And so it's very messy. But in the end, I was very grateful for that messiness because it allowed me to sort of confront what I would say much more interesting and really much more honest questions of like, what was I really trying to do with this building? And it really allowed me to sort of articulate the struggle of how I relate to my grandfather. What am I doing in his name? And what do I do with his legacy? In a way that, like, had I gotten the building back or had I not gotten the building back in a definitive way, it sort of would have been like, sort of like a very neat and a kind of a much more superficial narrative. I will say, though, since the build, like I've gotten a lot closer to reclaiming the building since I submitted the draft. In fact, like when, the day I submitted the draft, my editor, the final draft, we got word that the, you know, like the major hurdle had been cleared in the courts. And so we're actually quite close. So, you know, I'm kind of hoping it will all be decided before the actual publication of the book, which to me would be perfect, but. You know.
You can do a second edition when you add an epilogue.
I know. It really changed everything.
It's a great story. It's a great read. The book is called Plunder by Menachem Kaiser. Where can people go to find out more about you?
Well, they could go to my personal website. It's Menachem without the vowel, so MNCHM.com. Or I have a distinct name. Which I now recognize the advantages.
It's too Jewish.
You know, I will say I have met non-Jewish Menachems.
Wow.
I know. Yeah, they exist.
It's a consolation in its own way.
Yeah. But really, just if you Google my name or for the book, it's called Plunder, widely available wherever books are sold. Coming out March 16th.
Mazel tov. Congratulations on the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, brother.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Melissa Zimmerman, the Vice President of Clinical Services for Jewish Family and Children's Services of Southern Arizona, discussing counseling during the pandemic. Our playout this morning comes from the Three Cantors, part of their Yiddish medley. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a fun Super Bowl, and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Soll schon kommen die Geule, soll schon kommen die Geule, Mashiach kommt schon bald. Soll schon kommen die Geule, soll schon kommen die Geule, soll schon kommen die Geule, Mashiach kommt schon bald. Alle wollen der schöne Dame, hört schon alle hin, alle wollen der schöne Dame, mit zu wischen seh. Alle wollen der schöne Dame, hört schon alle hin, alle wollen der schöne Dame, mit zu wischen seh. Let's go.
schön war, es soll schön kommen die Ulle, 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 es schien.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.